Mr. Cameron, Reel 4. Now, that just about brings us to the end of your time at Carlisle. You then went for a fiery... The whole course was about 6 months, wasn't it? And at the end of it, did you go to Wales for your firing course, or did you go before the... I mean, was that part of the course?
We went after. And we go all the time at Carlisle, we went down to Darwin, maybe Australia, and we fired the guns there. And then we came back to Carlisle and went back to Carlisle.
What was the firing course like then at Tawin?
It was interesting, but it was rough.
What exactly did you do?
Well, let me say, we always stuck at Carlisle. Anyway, it was up in the cliff tops, looking over the Cardigan Bay. The guns were situated there. They filmed itself for...
Along?
All up on the cliffs. There was a 3.7 static. They had a lot of guns there. And we took turns in firing them. But there were so many hours that we spent more time standing watching the other boat firing.
And what did you think of it? I mean, the first time. What about the noise?
Well, the first time, you know, it was unusual. We still got used to that. The best thing was watching the others firing, and used to have a plane coming asleep, you know, and it used to be miles away from the really plane in the field at times, I think. But it's surprising.
Did you have any instruments? Were the instrument people there as well?
The instrument people were working. Where they had been in Carlisle, they had been instrument training.
So they give you the dial pointings for the sleeve.
That's right, yeah. They did the instrument work properly, correctly, but it wasn't the same.
How many shots would you fire then, do you think?
If we had a dozen goals, I think we'd be lucky in the fortnight. So
and when you fired, would you fire more than one shot at a time, or in those dozen goals?
Four or five on a one. That's a run across from you. That's the right through the whole procedure, you know, we had the command post, and we were there on the guns, and we... Somebody thought, sweet.
And how accurate was your little team? I mean, did you get them near the target ever? Mostly they were inaccurate, were they?
Yeah, well, the anti-aircraft fire was not really expected to get a big for the bombardment for the proper place. It's just a hook, as you might say. The way the instruments work and the protection you put in and the way you hammer the guns and the pipers and so on, all determined that you should hit. But the amount of being given there is such that it wouldn't be a proof that you actually hit the plane.
So it's more, the purpose was more that they fly into something. You have a sort of wall.
When you went on an active service, you served with a troop of 4 months.
Right, I'll come on, but at this stage you weren't doing that.
No.
Had you done any barrage theory? We'll come to it when you actually put it into practice then. So you were doing this course for about 2 weeks.
About a couple of weeks, actually.
And then back to Cardiff and
back
for the for the posting.
Yeah.
And where were you posted to?
I finished up in Yorkshire. I don't recollect just how we were posted or where. I know there was lists come up, you know, your name to so and so. I don't remember being told where I was going. I just know where I finished up.
And this was in April 1940.
It would be around about there.
Round, roughly. And what was the unit you were posted to? Now, what were they regulars or territorials or what?
This was where we got the advantage of being trained at Carlisle. Most of these folks were territorials. Some of them, they were all pre-war territorials, but some of them were practically beginners.
People who joined in
38, yes, you know. Similar to what I said previously. My mates went off to the war when I was still in the pits, so they knew less than me about soldiering me, you see, when I finished at Carlisle. And the same applied to these Yorkshire lads, where they were all from around Leeds, Wakefield, around that area anyway. And a lot of them knew less about them than they were needed.
Even though they'd been. So, how did they make you welcome? I mean, you were there many from Carlisle sent in, or were you on your own?
I think there were about a dozen of us who joined adrift here. I was brought out of Grundy, who came from
And he'd been with you at Carlisle?
Yeah.
What was his first name, Drew?
Harry.
So you weren't on your own? You weren't, you know?
Oh, no, we always found that we always had someone. But me and him sort of got around together. We seemed to fit together. We were expert men. And don't think it was the same sort of thing working on it.
And now you were posted to Driffield together. How did the battery receive you then? What do you remember how they took you into the battery and sorted you out?
No, there wasn't a lot to us. To them, we were beginners. and pretty much we were, because when I don't know how it is, but there was two, we went into a troop, which troop I don't know, but all of the troops that don't have a fire battery.
They had two, did they?
The two troops in the battery. But when we got there, there was no one there in this big foot. It was part of the RAF barracks, but a big building, and there was one big room where we were sent. And all the kit was made up on the floor. And it was still a bit light. It was getting near the dark, but it was still a bit light. When we got there, we were sent to this room, the kit there, right? And all of these boats came trooping in, as soon as it was dark, they came trooping in across the other guys, and we, you know, they were all sorted. So it was pretty quiet. And then we found out, of course, next morning, what they did. They got up before daybreak, they went out, there was a golf course outside of the car, of the camp. Airfield. They had a bear tent there, and they had one old 1914-19 machine gun on a post. And that was their defense. They didn't have any heavy anti-aircraft guns there.
So it was just a Vickers?
It was an old Vickers gun.
A Lewis? A Lewis gun then?
Oh, look, it's good, that's it, yeah. To the best of my knowledge, we spent about 3 weeks government there with them in this Lewis gun. That's what it was, the Lewis gun. Come out of Lewis gun on a post. But it was never heavy. I'd say it was heavy. It was going to be dark, and I'd be fired at anything. But I saw any aircraft.
What was it for you all to do in the troop, then?
There was nothing to do except to get out there in the morning. And the other room before, the other room before was to put Adblock on the forward of this boat, of course, until we could use the same group out in a hay box at dinner time. And we get back and go in on the evening and get a meal there.
So you weren't doing anything particularly?
Practically nothing. It was supposed to be our free defense, but we didn't have anything to defend with. Although we thought we were doing a good job with it. If Adina had to be trained from a place to the fire, the gun, I suppose, whether it did any effect on that.
So it was just one Lewis for your whole troop?
Well, I think it would be half the troop. It would be another half troop somewhere else, but another Lewis gun.
So that, and the other troop? The other whole troop would have another two Lewis's, probably.
Something like that, yeah.
Scattered round the field.
That was a setup. Mm.
Now, that went on for...
Not long. 2 or 3 weeks. Just what the hell it was, I don't know. There was a troop. When I left there, I was posted to Spain Point. That's right out the bone, around the whole area. I must have been with a troop which was at the airfield, and I must have been another troop out at Spare Point.
Ah.
When I got there, we had two guns there, 2 3-inch 1914-18 naval guns.
Not anti aircraft guns,
they were a combination. And they were what I would call the old spring naval. Screw gun, 3-inch thing that they would stick on the front of a Navy boat. But they were adaptable to anti-aircraft. Although they weren't the same as our own 3-inch anti-aircraft gun, which had the vertical reach. These were the screw reach thing, old as the hills. If you show it over there, two children, the same number.
Now, were they ver- wasn't you'd only done 3.7s at the time, hadn't you?
Yeah.
So did it? I mean, when you'd learned one gun, I mean, could you adapt to another one?
Easy. The number 2 and 3 is exactly the same. The normally the heat
Was that cause, just because the shell was lighter and smaller?
Yeah, lighter and smaller, and your gun cover as well would have been a little bit.
Would you really have, would you still get things coming in from the predictor, from the instruments, or would you?
Yes.
So they've been adapted to.
Well, yes, we still have the instruments. So when we were out there on Spurn Point, those conditions were cold. Can't say horrible. They were conditions you wouldn't expect. You would expect to find in places like that. To be. You would. You know, it was no time. It was a set up, a quick set up, get this done, get a couple of rooms there, stick a couple of huts up, get them some water there.
So you were in huts? You were in huts?
Yeah, in huts, we were in huts. There must be about 100 huts of some kind, about the number of years of huts, but there was about 4 or 5 huts, one that we ate in, 3 we slept in.
And the whole troop was out there. They had what?
A rugby ball. I never saw a rugby ball outside of the shop window. I went to the Yorkshire, you know. That's where the ball was played
from. How did you get on with the Yorkshire lads?
Funny at first.
In what way?
With us having an accent. But they were okay.
Could you understand each other? I mean.
Oh, yes. After the few days, we had no trouble with each other. Soon settled in. And in fact, I made mates there. But I didn't think I'd ever contact anyone again. But still, they had a phone call up this year. And they had seen my name in one of the bill of identity things. And they got in contact with me. And he was, that was from. Last time I saw him was 1942 in Africa, and he was on this place at
Spurn Point. Now, what was your sort of daily routine then while you were at Spurn Point? Because
there's very little routine. What I do, you got to hear about breakfast, you went out and you shaved it. There was no hot water there, by the way. You got out outside, there was a water pipe, an old sort of homemade trough for biscuit tin things and wooden bench, and a couple of places where you could turn it up on. You get stuck in and you wash and shave, and there was a cold water that was up. But something like a breakfast, and then you might go and do an hour or so gun drill on the guns.
And then just practicing.
Practicing. And then cleaning, but you still a bit maintenance, cleaning, throwing down and throw and so on.
That was all you'd do?
That's all we had to do.
You weren't the limber gunner. I know you later on became a limber gunner, but not at that stage.
Well, we all did that sort of work. It wasn't. It was only about 7 or 8 to a pro winner. And you always a lot of fatigues besides taking the guns.
What would they be?
The data bashing for the dough for the start for dinner, you know, sport bashing and foot cleaning. There is pumping coal. I just forget what you usually have, but.
So that was the sort of routine you had, a bit of work on the gun. After you'd done your gun drill and you're cleaning the gun, was there anything, would you have a crew on the gun all day? Or
You had a duty, so it was made up when it was for a week or something. That was the crew that responded if there was an alarm. And the command post, so you had a command post there as well, and they had a spotter's out all the time. They were instrument men, obviously, they weren't gunners, but there was a couple of spotters, and they were a couple of hours on, and they were relieved by another couple of spotters. You know, they would sit there and stay.
And what would they be using, the spotters?
They had a the end of the years, but they also, the coldest way is, and it had the bearing down in the centre, two eyepieces, either side, it swung around, and you could read the bearings off in the way that it took it, very much like a small eye finder. That gave you a bearing, but of course they had to get that out of a plane before they could give you any information. So they were looking for the planes with the binoculars. It was waiting all the time. And you'd be up at the sea, possibly all day.
So did they have the alarm, or would they, if they saw something, would they tell the command post?
Whistles.
So they'd tell
the command post. They were at the command post.
The spotters, yeah.
And the predictor was there in the command post, and there would be instrument men.
And what was their alarm to you? The whistles?
I think it was mainly whistles and the shout, of course.
So you were, if you were on gun crew, you weren't allowed to go too far away, I presume?
No, we didn't go with, out of the camp, but we never got too far away from the instrument, so it wasn't.
Now, were did you have any searchlights working in conjunction with them?
No, but the spurred point, there was nothing there except those and the lighthouse.
So did you have it?
You presumed there was a keeper in the lighthouse, because sometimes he used to see his daughter walking in the lighthouse, keeper's daughter, walking along the shore to the lighthouse. That's all there was, the spurred point.
So, did you bother having a crew on call at night?
If you
I was going to ask, did you have any alarms at all?
Nothing.
So, you didn't even see any planes?
Nothing at all. And yet, it did get a place later on. The time we spent there, we had no trouble at all. We had the best of the summer in 1940 that I can remember.
So that was during the summer.
Yeah.
What about social life or anything? I mean, recreations.
There was none. We kicked that rugby ball about, or we got down there and I was talking. I was there about talking all the time I was with the I used to play a few tunes, and he'd sit around and sing. You just maintained your kick, and you kept the bed early.
I mean, it's pretty isolated. Was there any pub or anything you could go out to?
Nothing. The only time I remember, it was like a march to where the village was. It was a little bit of a village. I don't recollect much what was in it. But there was about four of us went to where the houses were, and we had four pushbacks. And we went from there right through a lot of country lanes to a seaside place where they could probably be up the coast. I don't remember the name of the place, but it was a bushbuck place somewhere, Windlessly, I think it was. We biked there, and when we got there, we had this place, and we had a lot of people back in there, biked back. And the only time I remember ever coming out.
So it was very isolated. Did you get bored?
Well, I don't suppose we get bored, yet we wouldn't get bored, because it was hard.
I was going to say, how did it compare with the mines? I mean,
but this is what you say. I'd sooner sit looking at the Atlantis and sports players be down that bit.
Were many of the Yorkshire lads miners as well?
They were a whole mixture. There was very few miners. The both were all strangely enough from quite a different background. There was bank clerks, drama boy, drama school. Grammar school, office boys, quite a lot of them, you know, and yet we got on well with them.
What about the NCOs?
They were okay, but there was nothing comparable with the men from Carolina. in the cinema for the car all the time. They were civilians, as you might say, but they were territorial NCOs. They were neither, they weren't bad at their job, they weren't good at their job. As we found out later, they were the NCOs and they did what they said.
Were but they less disciplined?
The extent of the discipline and the
I mean, did you prefer it like that at first?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was better for us. It was a much relaxed life. If you didn't, if you step out wrong, it would change. If you didn't step out wrong, well, everybody was happy.
When did you first notice that you were better trained yourself as a gunner than some of these territorials? When did that become apparent?
I think that it was taken away from those finish guns. Don't get it where we moved from the field to where we came under the 3.7s. But then, it did become one definitely when she moved to the 3.7s. But I can't remember where we did that. But then again, the jobs that me and Bundy did, because we were used to it, we'd get straight under the job and we'd start cleaning and we'd do the things that we were expected to do. And then I would be told, and then there was all the lining up drills where we were there to do it, we were keen to do it, where these others were guessing what to do. We were there to do it straight away with you, and we didn't. So that's for me the NCO for the broken charge, the gun position, the total assistant and position officer, usually a sergeant, he'd be shouting at us.
So would you get, what job would you be given on the gun? That's just from your greater experience.
That's it.
What about the officers of the troop? What were they at Spurn Point? What were they like?
The one we had at Spurn Point, I can remember best. I don't remember his name, I think, but the number of others, and we only had the one officer, the lieutenant. He didn't bother the mother of the city, all he did, the master arm was a bulldog. And he had a caravan, he lived in a caravan, a little bit away from. Not a long way, but a little bit on the camp, you know.
And he'd be in at the gun position.
He was in charge. He was the captain.